Hello and welcome to On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. I'm your host, Hannah Stanley, and today we're talking about the promise of restorative justice, which is a relatively new concept gaining support for juvenile justice reform. We have great guests lined up for this hour, but before I jump into that, I do want to remind you that you can find all of our podcasts and you can subscribe via iTunes and they will just auto-populate for you. You can also go to WGNplus.com. If you have any challenges in finding it, go to WGNplus.com and you'll find all of our podcasts there, and it'll be super easy to subscribe that way. Now, with us today is Elena Quintana, Executive Director of Adler's Institute on Public Safety and Social Justice. Elena, why don't you start, please, by explaining how the current juvenile justice system operates and what needs to change?
Well, thanks for having me. I can talk a little bit about the juvenile justice system. It does vary by state, but I do think it's important to note that the way that it has ramped up in punishment, particularly since the mid-90s, that we entered in a period of punishing what were described as super predators. And we started talking about children, particularly African-American children, as predators rather than as precious. And I think it's really important to see how much more punitive we became with children, which, as we went along and developed science, we started learning that we were forever curtailing their human potential by treating children as adults. And so that's the biggest danger that of a trend that has happened in juvenile justice. And I think now, given all of the advances of science and a greater understanding of childhood trauma and the way it affects young people, we're starting to scale back and to start thinking of children as children again and start thinking about how do we weigh out the need for accountability with the need to also foster positive human development.
So what are we learning about juvenile incarceration and how it is affecting the juveniles who are incarcerated?
I think what sticks out to me, and I can't put too fine a point on this, it's incredibly racially skewed. In the Cook County is just a little under half white, and it's about, you know, a quarter African American and a quarter Latino. That's rough figures, but it's those are rough figures. But if you look in the juvenile detention center, it's about 86% or 87% African American, and pretty much the balance is made up of Latinos. So you'll see that there's really two kinds of justice that are meted out. It's not like all kids don't make mistakes or sometimes get arrested for things. It's that we treat and respond to juvenile crime involvement very differently.
Okay. So many questions. So is this because of the neighborhoods and the justice system within those areas where their population exists? Or is it access to different levels or quality of legal representation?
I think part of it is that it's overlaid on economics as well, in that, you know, I seem to find in conversations with different justice system people, whether it be police or judges or even state's attorneys or public defenders, that the greater hope there is for a young person to have resources or to be rehabilitated, which usually requires resources, and if a family can provide that, then it's seen as a bigger crime to criminalize this person than if there's less of a hope of this kind of rehabilitation taking place. And we really need to level that playing field so all people have a fair shot at rehabilitation and in joining the mainstream in earnest.
We have Father Dave Kelly joining us later to talk more about resources that are available, particularly in the Chicagoland community. Tell me some of you've mentioned that it is racially skewed, at least here in the city of Chicago, and probably that echoes throughout different communities in the country. But what are some of the issues that are most egregious with juvenile incarceration?
What people don't understand is sometimes, and I have great sympathy and empathy for families that have experienced serious crime committed against them. I've met numerous parents who have lost children to other children shooting them. And that's not small. It's an enormous thing. And I'm in no way trying to downplay the effect that crime has on people. What I do think is so important that society is missing, and I can't say this enough, is that when we think about how serious crime demands a serious response, we're totally messing up what a serious response means, like what's going to be effective serious response. The worst thing we can do is to lock somebody up and throw away the key. Particularly for children, this is an egregious offense on human development because we are just basically throwing away any kind of change or transformation that we think a young person can make. And so I think it is incumbent upon our society to invest in people that are presenting public safety challenges, that are presenting threats to public safety, in order to make them better citizens. Otherwise, we're just basically colluding to make them tax dependent inmates all of their natural lives. And who is that serving? It's serving no one.
So tell me more, if you will, kind of a broad stroke overview of restorative justice.
So restorative justice is really this idea that you can work through building relationships either with communities or individuals that you have harmed, and that actually, when we look at an analysis of restorative justice programming, particularly when it's used within the criminal justice system or within communities, it really is more of a satisfactory process, both for people who have been harmed and for people who have harmed others. And what it means is, instead of a traditional kind of way of going through the system where you go through a judge, you may not ever see the person that you harmed. Say I, you know, mugged you and ripped off your purse, and then later even you had a house key in your purse and I went in your garage and I stole a bunch of stuff out of your garage. That would be an enormous violation. I mean, enormous, no doubt. But if we went through a restorative, I mean, if you go through a traditional justice process, then, you know, I may be serving jail time and I wouldn't have any kind of future or whatever. If we go through a restorative process, again, I may be detained for a period of time. But what could happen is you and I could talk to each other and I could say, I have a serious situation where I'm trying to feed my children and I didn't know what to do. And you were somebody who looked like you had a lot of money. And then I saw your key and your ID and I went in there and I knew I could sell this stuff on eBay or whatever. And I just got desperate and I'm really sorry and I need help and you paid the price because I need help and I didn't know where to turn. Well, your experience of feeling victimized and feeling scared in the world is also transformed, just as my sense of accountability toward an actual human being is also transformed. So we are both better for a process of being able to interact in a mediated, constructive way. And so you may be like, okay, I don't want you to serve 20 years in prison. I don't think of you as like this crazy psychopath anymore who has no ability to transform themselves. I'm really thinking of you as a struggling person who in a moment of desperation did some really pretty horrible things.
All right. So it, to some degree, allows the victim to have some degree of understanding and put the potential for forgiveness at some level, which is restorative to them as well, because they're traumatized because of what has happened. And then it also provides an ability for accountability to the perpetrator for realizing who they harmed and what effect it had on them.
Yes.
And then also to allow them to ask for help.
Yes. So it really also gets community involved. So instead of being a perpetrator and you a victim, I'm someone who caused harm in this instance, and you're somebody who was harmed. But it also means that a community of people will come around both of us to provide us with the support and help to promote transformation that is really needed in the situation. So then it basically means that I will be less likely to perpetrate in the future, and you will feel safer in the future having really met the person that has given you so much heartache or fear or whatever.
Because you no longer necessarily see them as a scary monster.
You have
that interaction with that person.
Yes.
And understand some of the motivation behind it.
Yes. It's incredibly powerful, and not just for small crimes like, you know, stealing an iPhone or something like that, something that could be seen as like kind of depersonalized and doesn't really infringe upon somebody's sense of safety. It is also incredibly powerful in very serious crimes such as rape and murder, which you would not really, most of the people think, well, saying you're sorry, that, you know,
it doesn't bring them back. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. It doesn't bring it back. Mm-hmm. But for people who have taken other people's lives, many of them, particularly when we're talking about juvenile justice, they change as adults. And if you think about brain development, like as young people, you can pull a trigger at 14 and not have any idea of what you're doing. But then your frontal lobe develops and you have this entirely different set of adult senses around the harm that you caused. And all you want to do as an adult person is to make amends to the people that you harmed.
The brain doesn't develop fully until it's 25-ish.
Mid-20s, yeah.
It's amazing to me.
Mm-hmm.
But, oh boy.
Right. So
we're given so much responsibility as youth, and I understand that some people can handle it, but then we have these situations and you go, you're a baby, even though you're not, but you are. Your brain isn't developed.
Right.
This is a very familial. You know, if my child does something wrong, I don't send them away. Sometimes I send them to their room, but there is still the moment where we have to kind of have the reckoning. You know, you did something wrong.
Right.
There will be a punishment, but we still love you, and you're still an okay person, and we are still going to work to make you better. And
right.
This is like the community being the family.
So the idea of restorative justice, I know Kay Prannis, who's very involved in developing restorative justice and how we learn about it in the States, talked about it as if a community is a beautiful tapestry, you don't make that tapestry stronger by pulling out the threads and throwing them away. You really protect the integrity of a tapestry. And that means that in terms of a community, that you protect all of the community members as they belong to that community. And we really claim each other and belong to each other. And if we respond to each other in that way, then we strengthen the fabric of the community.
This is On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. I am Hannah Stanley, and currently I am joined by Elena Quintana, Executive Director of I wanted to make sure I said that correctly. Currently, I'm joined by Elena Quintana, Executive Director of Adler's Institute on Public Safety and Social Justice. All right, so we've been talking about restorative justice. Tell me how it's better than what we do now. I mean, we've been discussing this, but give me a few.
I have a great story for you. I work with the Education Justice Project in Danville Correctional Center once a month, and I work with a group of older gentlemen who mostly were tried for murder or attempt murder when they were between, you know, anywhere between the ages of 14 and 20 years old, and have received long sentences anywhere from 40 years to life. And what they do is just try to address their own trauma and work with people with shorter sentences so that when they get out to Chicago communities, that they won't reoffend or offend other people violently, because they are really working on understanding and addressing their own trauma. And many of them have wanted more than anything in the world to undergo a restorative process with their victims' families. But the state actually prohibits this from happening and makes it in many cases, very, very difficult for people in prison to do that. And I really wish that we would create more of a reasonable way that could benefit both people who have harmed and people who have been harmed.
So if we have someone who's serving a sentence for murder, they want to reach out and apologize to the family. They're not able to do that?
Desperately, yes. And so there is theoretically a way that you can talk to the police chief or you could talk to the state's attorney. But many times these people have written dozens of letters and have not been able to be connected with anyone who will engage them in a restorative process, even if both sides very much want that.
Notes I have in front of me, restorative justice, the youth are less likely to reoffend and reenter the justice system. As you've mentioned, it teaches accountability and forces youth to consider the impact of their crimes, which is, to me, living outside of these communities seems to be so crucial, because if you grow up into the system, you don't necessarily know that there's what the victim side of it is, because this is just kind of the community norm for some of these kids.
It absolutely prevents recidivism, because when young people feel that they're not wanted, they just keep cycling through the juvenile justice system and then the adult court system. There is nothing that is a greater predictor of adult incarceration than juvenile detention.
We've also touched on the fact that it helps repair the damages to the victims.
Absolutely.
And because they feel like they're a part of the solution,
right,
they're not going to then act out.
Because there's a human connection that's made between the person who's harmed and the person who has caused harm. And when that connection is made, it really neutralizes the kind of power that distance has held for so long.
And it also reduces the desire for revenge.
Exactly.
It keeps potential of human capital in the community. That's fascinating.
Absolutely. When I think about all of the people that are of no benefit to public safety whatsoever behind bars, and I think about how powerful they can be, or actually are, once they are released 40 years into their sentence, I am just amazed at the amount of intelligence and human capacity. I mean, many people who cause harm are some of the greatest and most zealous supporters of stopping the violence and of turning young people's lives around.
Because they've seen it from the other side.
Yes, they've lived it. They have lived it, and all they want to do is to give back to the communities and repair the harm that they contributed to.
While we have discussed so many good reasons for this program to be commonplace and be adopted and integrated into our current justice system, the one that's going to get people's ears picking up is the fact that it's less expensive and it delivers more positive return on investment. Tell me what the facts are.
Absolutely. So if you know, just the dollars and cents, it costs so much money to hold a young person in a juvenile detention center or in the state. I mean, really, just for what it costs, we could basically put him up in the Drake and give him a private tutor and send him to Harvard. I mean, it's ridiculous how much we spend for each young person going into the juvenile temporary detention center or YCC beyond that. I mean, it's really almost, that is kind of criminal in my mind, because if we had invested that much money on the front end, they wouldn't be going there, you know, ever.
Right.
So basically, if we have restorative services and processes and circles and opportunities within communities, we prevent a whole lot of juvenile crime or crime in communities, period. And then also, it promotes shorter lengths of sentences, and it also neutralizes or transforms people's lives so that they don't continue to be threats to public safety.
And as you've mentioned a couple of times before, we gain advocates in the community for stopping the violence
or
additional community programs, et cetera.
Absolutely.
So fascinating. Thank you so much, Elena. When we come back, we're going to talk with a community development expert about the economic benefits of investing in justice reform. Also, please, if you found this information valuable, and I'm not sure how you couldn't, feel free to share on social media and subscribe to us on iTunes. You can find all of our fine podcasts at WGNplus.com. This is On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. Hannah Stanley with you, and we'll be back after this. We're back for part two of our episodes of The Promise of Restorative Justice. I'm Hannah Stanley, and this is On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. You can find this podcast, you probably did find it, on WGNplus.com, and please remember to subscribe as well so you can get all of our great content. Right now, I'm joined by Dan Cooper, co-executive director of Adler's Institute on Social Exclusion. Dan, you say justice reform is both a moral and financial issue, and that there are very clear economic reasons to move towards restorative justice. Please tell me more.
Sure. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here. And so just in case you weren't swayed by Elena's arguments about the personal and transformative benefits of restorative justice, I'm going to zoom out a little bit and talk about how the average taxpayer should really care about this because, yes, it's a moral issue, but it's also a common sense economic issue, right? So Elena touched a little bit on how expensive it is. Just to elaborate on that further, locking up a young person typically costs about $500 a day. The average length of stay in a juvenile detention center here in Cook County is about 30 days. So, that's about $15,000 locking up a young person for a month, we could have them in the Drake Hotel, right? And this is particularly problematic given the track record of absolute failure of juvenile detention and adult incarceration. So the reoffense rate in Illinois for juveniles is something around between 50 and 60%. So that means once a young person is locked up, there is greater than a 50% chance that they're going to go back in again. In any other circumstance, this would be looked at as a dismal failure, right? If this were a business or if this were education outcomes, you would say, wow, this is a scandal. We're failing half the time. This clearly is not rehabilitating people. So for something this costly, we should be going all in on looking for other alternatives like restorative justice. To zoom out from just this cost perspective, young people are returning to a very small number of neighborhoods, like Back of the Yards in Englewood, which you're going to hear about in a second, from Father Kelly. So that means that one of the greatest investments we're making in neighborhoods is in suppression and forced removal. Some folks in New York at Columbia University coined the term million-dollar blocks, meaning that on some blocks, just a block, we commit to spending over the life of sentences over $1 million locking people up.
Per block.
In a community like Austin, this could mean, hundreds of millions of dollars committed, taxpayer dollars committed to locking people up. For an approach that fails 50% of the time.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Because if we were actually like going to whiteboard this with a group of taxpayers, they would go, no, this needs to get fixed now.
Yeah.
But we're so used to the system the way it is.
Right.
And not necessarily knowing more about the alternatives.
That's exactly right.
So see, people, you're so smart for listening because we're presenting we're presenting the options.
Yeah, thanks for pointing that out. And another thing I should also mention is that not only is this costly and not cost effective, it's actually harmful not only to the young people in terms of psychological damage and trauma, but it's harmful to families and neighborhoods as well. So this investment we're making in locking people up is actually hurting neighborhoods. So there's some really compelling research that has shown that incarceration, juvenile detention, are making neighborhoods perhaps even less safe. And like you said, all because we're sort of hooked on this approach and we can't really think outside of the box and think about a better approach to public safety. So for example, the violent crime rate has been going down pretty steadily since the early 90s. And the incarceration rate at the same time has been going up, but has leveled off a little bit in recent years. And so there's a temptation to say, oh, well, maybe incarceration is responsible for that crime rate going down. But some folks have actually studied that. Some folks at the Brennan Center at New York University found that the drop in violent crime is only marginally, at best, attributable to incarceration. To incarceration. What it's more attributable to is things like growth in income, employment rates, a decrease in alcohol and substance abuse. So all these things that we would think of as positive social programs, social support, community development, are actually the things that are driving public safety, not incarceration. And then what's worse, we know from even more recent studies, is that incarceration is actually responsible, perhaps, for an increase in poverty. Some folks from Villanova did a study recently showing that the poverty rate would actually be much lower had we not been incarcerating at the rate we are. And then also crime. A researcher at Rutgers, Todd Clear, showed that in several different cities where we incarcerate more, we see later rises in crime rates.
All right. So the people who are incarcerated when they come out then recommit crime?
That's exactly right. Okay. So there's this revolving door effect where people are leaving a community, going to prison, coming back with a record, a stigma.
Harder to find jobs.
Harder to find jobs. If you're a young person, you're less likely to finish school. You're less likely to find a job. And then you're excluded to the margins. And one of your only options, as you see it, is perhaps, selling drugs or doing something else in the informal economy. And crucially, most of these youth, as we'll hear from Father Kelly, are typically failed by systems, schools. They feel disconnected from adults and every system they've been a part of. And so these are the folks who are, who are going to be our reentrants, who form this revolving door effect.
Right before this last stat that you expounded upon, you said that incarceration actually increases poverty level. I think you said it was a Villanova mm-hmm. study. Tell me a little bit more about that, please.
Yeah, so they basically looked at the poverty rate and looked at incarceration across the states, and they did a couple models to look at what poverty would have been without incarceration, and actually would have been lower, right? So
because we're incarcerating workforce,
right? Exactly. So they're returning, they're not finding jobs, they're sort of excluded from employment, more likely to reoffend, crime goes up, poverty goes up.
This
vicious cycle. And again, we have this very short-term memory because these are the same communities that were victims of redlining in the 60s. And we sort of ignore that. They're the same communities that are victims to failed schools, to predatory lending just 10 years ago, to foreclosures, and more recently, school closures and state budget impasse, which has decimated the social safety net and social services. And so to look at juvenile justice without considering all these other terrible policy effects that have impacted these neighborhoods would be an incomplete picture. So, essentially, these young people are being punished. These neighborhoods are being punished in the form of years of bad policy.
Adler is located here in Chicago. All of our guests for these three segments on restorative justice are located here in the city of Chicago. But I appreciate that you're bringing in backup from across the country, and because these our community is not alone. This is something that's mirrored throughout the country. And these are concepts that you can carry on into your own community and really start to address and incorporate these ideas that we've been discussing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell me what investments we can make to do it better.
That's a great question. So we're going to hear very shortly from an excellent program, a restorative justice program that works comprehensively with young people in a very cost-effective way. But in general, thinking about neighborhoods where young people come from, who are typically locked up or face disproportionate contact with the justice system, are the same areas that have all sorts of issues, right? Mental health services are underfunded, education systems are failing, workforce development, we're constantly cutting programs that are meant to help the young people and families in these neighborhoods. It seems like every week we hear of a new social service provider who's had to shutter their programs because of the current budget impasse, which is essentially an ideological fight with, you know, the victims being the people who are most marginalized in society. I think Lutheran Social Services just a week or two ago announced they had to shutter their programs. They provide services to nearly 5,000 people, employ 750 people. So in general, we need to redirect money from the juvenile justice system, from the criminal justice system in general, into all sorts of programs that would help lift up families, give them job skills, access to better health and education. And for young people, importantly, there are programs we know that help connect them to their peers, to adults, to school, and, you know, restorative justice programs, restorative justice hubs in particular, are one that really work to take a comprehensive approach to mentoring youth, to helping them build social skills, you know, peer relationships, connecting them with their community in ways that incarceration sort of doesn't do.
Now is the hard question, because we are already in the vicious cycle. We have a very ingrained system, and we have an issue with our budget. Many, many states and municipalities have budgetary issues where everybody's cutting money, and it is harming those who are most at risk. That's fact, because those are programs that are easier to cut. And where do we step in to stop this? We want to incorporate restorative justice. That's going to cost money. We want to make sure that we can rehabilitate people either prior to going to jail or when they come out. That's going to cost money. So at what point, where is it most ideal to step in and go, okay, we're going to stop the cycle now, and I'm going to do it how?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the good news is that we have an area we could easily find cuts because it's the most expensive approach, and that's detention and incarceration, right? As I mentioned earlier, the $500 a day cost figure. Restorative justice programs, you know, may cost a couple, you know, several hundred dollars or several thousand dollars per youth, and that's, you know, much less than this $15,000 per month from locking up a young person. So the first thing is to look really hard at where we're sentencing young people and do everything we can to divert them from the system into something that's more cost effective. That's something that can yield some savings very quickly. And there are approaches that do this. Illinois has a program called Redeploy Illinois, which is supposed to provide financial incentives for diverting young people away from incarceration and into better evidence-based programs and supports. But, you know, the program has had some success, but it hasn't really taken hold in Cook County, and there are ways we can go much deeper. There are states that have done this over a longer period of time and have seen some pretty successful results. Ohio is one, for example. They found out, or they realized very quickly in the early 90s that they had a problem when there were 2,500 youth in the juvenile correction system, where they only had the capacity for 1,400. And so not only is that a problem for safety for these young people, it's also massively expensive, right? And so they embarked on a 20-year effort to de-incarcerate and shift expenses into better evidence-based programs, mental health programs, substance abuse programs, social support, mentoring, similar to kind of what programs exist here in Chicago, not exactly the same, but and then rigorously testing what works. And then they've showed over the years that some things haven't worked, but they've steered things more and more to approaches that do. And they've been able to reduce their incarceration budget by a huge factor.
Cook County has what I believe is a trial program for the Veterans Court. It's Veterans Court, and they go into a special system, and they have very rigorous, as you just laid out, psychological help and programs to get them through substance abuse and things like that. Is this something that could be modeled after that, which is working? from what I understand, where there can be you have to qualify for this, but then we can go, look, it works. See, this is proven. We can do this because it has to be something where they're going to see that it works, or nobody's going to agree to it, because nobody wants to be the politician that lets the kid out that then, you know, goes and does this horrible crime again.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the good news is there's plenty of evidence out there about restorative justice practices being effective, of mentorship programs and other programs for youth, mental health and behavioral health programs working. So there's a body of literature. I think you heard Elena mention it earlier. You know, young people who go through a restorative justice program are, you know, maybe half as or, you know, 50% less likely to reoffend, for example. So I think it's a combination of investing in what we know works, but then also taking a rigorous social science approach and saying we're going to do everything we can to test new approaches that work and not just rely on the same old, same old. The irony here is that juvenile detention and adult incarceration are not evidence-based programs. We know they're failures, actually, because half the people go back in, right? Mm-hmm. There's no evidence really to suggest that that's working and rehabilitating people, but yet we hold any alternative to a higher standard and say, ooh, we're a little bit hesitant to invest in that because we're not sure that's an evidence-based program yet. And I think we need to be a little bit more bold in looking at all sorts of innovative approaches that do everything they can to connect young people with families and with community, like restorative justice practices do.
So we have the backup. We have the ability to look and say, look, this is proven. It's more effective. At least it's more effective than what we're currently doing.
That's right.
How do we get this change implemented? Is this through the politicians, or is this judges, local courts? How do we get this to work?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's something that Illinois has a commission on criminal justice sentencing reform right now that are providing some recommendations for adults. And you know, I think one of the big recommendations is to really you know, invest in evidence-based approaches, but also, you know, one thing we would push is say, you know, justice reinvestment now, right? Just let taxpayers know, the public know, how much we're spending and wasting on ineffective programs that are ruining young people's lives, destroying neighborhoods. So I think above all, what, you know, we need more public education. We need a movement so that people really know this, how ineffective their system is, and can put a little bit of pressure on, you know, politicians. I think there are state level opportunities for legislation, but also judges need to be educated, probation, parole. I think, you know, the justice system is not just a unidimensional system. It's a living, breathing organism with a lot of different tentacles. So I think there will have to be a lot of approaches to make this work.
Which is true in so many different aspects of this system and many others. Dan Cooper joining me right now. He's the co-executive director of Adler's Institute on Social Exclusion. And this is On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. I'm Hannah Stanley. I want to address, you've mentioned a few times that Elena Quintana was with us in a previous podcast. So if you're looking for that, please do so at WGNplus.com. Or you can subscribe via iTunes or whatever method you download your podcasts from. We will be on there as well. And again, it is On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. And then coming up next, we have Father Kelly talking about a program that is working in the community and helping to bring around some restorative justice in Chicago's South Side. Thank you, Dan, so much for your time and your figures that you brought us, really proving, driving home the point that this is a better option for many, many communities, including our own. As I mentioned before, please do subscribe. And if you like what you have heard and are interested, please feel free to share it on your social media networks. Hannah Stanley here. This is On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. We will continue with Father Kelly in our next podcast. part three of our episode, The Promise of Restorative Justice. In the previous segments, we've discussed the problems with our current justice system and the economic benefits of moving to a restorative justice model, especially for juvenile offenders. I'm Hannah Stanley, host of On Social Health and Change podcast, brought to you by Adler University. Joining us now is Father Dave Kelly, Executive Director of Precious Blood Ministry of Reconciliation, a working restorative justice program on Chicago's South Side. Father Kelly, can you start by telling us about Precious Blood?
Precious Blood Ministry of Reconciliation, or a lot of the young people call it the Center, is an organization in the South Side of Chicago on 51st and Elizabeth. And we work with young people who are court involved. So these are young people who are coming out of juvenile detention center, the Department of Correction, or otherwise court involved, and their families. And we strive to create a space within the community in which they really feel like they belong, like they're part of that community. We also reach out to families and those who are victims of violence. And when it's possible, we bring those two groups, someone who has been victimized and someone who may have caused the harm, we try to bring those groups together.
Yeah, and unfortunately in our city, there's not a lack of people to work with.
Right. There are a lot of opportunities to use restorative practices. The practice we use most is the peacemaking circle because it builds community. It doesn't just deal with issues, but rather deals with the relationships between the people. In a community in which a lot of times the victim and the offender live in the same community, trying to renew and restore and repair those relationships is hugely important.
Tell me about some of your core principles that you work with.
There are five really principles or pillars, we call them, of a restorative justice hub. And this is not just Precious Blood, but other organizations that are also working with us to kind of develop this effort of responding to violence, crime, conflict in a restorative fashion. So the first is hospitality. I call it radical hospitality because it's inviting and welcoming young people who otherwise don't always come to your door kind of ready to be received well. They have attitudes. They have issues going on. They are victims of trauma. And so they don't come to your door always in that kind of mood, if you will, to be received well. So radical hospitality means we have to open those doors really wide. We have to work real hard to make them feel like they're safe and that they're welcome. The other is accompaniment. And accompaniment is really important. It's the commitment we have to the young person. It's also the understanding that we don't have the answers, that the young person or their family, they a lot of times know what they need. They just don't have access to it, or they don't have the strength or someone to walk along with them. So accompaniment is walking alongside a young person or a family member to help them access the resources that are needed. So if it's about school, so we go with them to the school. So it's not a referral. We go with them to the school. We sit in the front office. We wait to be called in. We go in with them, and we come home with them. And if we're successful, we celebrate. If we're not so successful, then we do it the next day. And
Plan B. Okay.
So the other is really being in relentless engagement of young people. So a lot of people will say, well, you know, if you fit this kind of this attitude or this criteria, then you can be a part of our group. Really, we really meet young people where they're at. So if a kid on the street corner and I say, hey, what's up, and invite him perhaps to some program that we're having, and he says, hey, thanks, Father Kelly, but no thanks, I'm still going to be in a relationship with that young person. So I recognize where they're at and don't sever relationships just because they might not be ready to participate in some of the program we have. So it's really important to, if a kid is ready, we're there. Because that young person who says thanks but no thanks, you know, in a week, a month, or something happens, he might come up to me and say, hey, Father Kelly, can you help me get in school? Can you help me get a job? So we have to be ready to have that relationship with that person so that when he or she is ready, that family is ready to make a move or wants some help, then we're there for them.
Okay.
The other is relentless engagement of systems and stakeholders. This is harder for me personally because I have a lot of patience for a 14-year-old who acts like a 14-year-old. I don't have as much patience for a system, whether that be Chicago Public Schools or whoever it might be, that act like 14-year-olds. And so I have to really try to build relationships with those folks so that we can really work for the betterment of the community, betterment of the family and the child. And the last principle or pillar, we call them, is collaboration. And it's really that I don't have all the answers. I can't do it all myself. I work with other organizations, other restorative justice hubs, Adler University, and anyone else in order to work together to really make a difference in our communities.
our community can be viewed as special because of the number of people that we have and the amount of violence we have in our community. But it can also be scaled into different communities and be mirrored. So this is something that talking about this isn't just about this city, the city of Chicago, and what you do in your particular community. This is something that can really apply to other areas. But while we are talking about what you do specifically, tell me who you guys serve.
We serve those young people, their families, who are in the Back of the Yards and Inglewood communities. So we're right on the border of the Back of the Yards and Inglewood. So Garfield Boulevard, 55th Street, is the border between Inglewood and Back of the Yards. So that's the population we serve. Most of the young people are African American. It's generational poverty. So it's a community that has, we all hope that our children will have a better life than we do. Well, in these kinds of communities, oftentimes our children don't have as good as a life as their parent or their grandparents. So it's a community that is rich in just being together and loving one another and caring for one another, but they don't always know how to do that. So, I oftentimes say, because we're real quick to demonize people, to label people as bad parents or bad kid or bad whatever. And the parents that I meet, they're loving parents, but they don't always have the ability to live into that love. So there's so much stress and strain in their lives that they don't always act the way they would want to act if they could. And so it's that kind of a community that's dealing with turmoil and hardship and struggle and strain. And if we can help them find a space and place to live in some sense of peace, then they are incredibly loving and caring people.
A lot of the youth you guys are working with is 90% court involved. Tell me specifically, give me some parameters of what that includes.
Court involved, I'm chaplain of juvenile detention center. So court involved means I met the kid while he's locked up and recognize he's from our community or close to our community. And so I'll build a relationship, of course, while he's there. And then when he gets home, come back into the community, then I hope to continue that relationship. So court involved means probation officers seeking us out to see if we can help with a client they might have. Going to court. This morning we had a couple of staff members going to court to represent the community, to be there for this young person and his family. So court involved means we go to the courts themselves. And so all these kids have a case, some sort of case pending, or have had a case pending. 90% of the kids we deal with are court involved.
What kind of cases are we talking about? Are we talking gun violence? Are we talking drugs? I mean, where are we on the scale of severity?
We're talking about all of the above. So it's a kid who gets picked up for jaywalking and gets a ticket for $500 because they jaywalked in our community. It's about a kid who is sitting right now in Cook County Jail on a murder charge. So it's being in relationship with that kid and his family. It's about a young kid who came to the center this morning who happens to have a warrant out for his arrest because he missed court. And it's creating an environment and a relationship with him where he feels safe enough to come to me and talk to me about that and to see if I'll help him try to turn himself in. So it's those kinds of young people that we're servicing.
This is the On Social Health and Change podcast. I'm Hannah Stanley. It is brought to you by Adler University. And currently we are talking with Father Dave Kelly, Executive Director of the Precious Blood Ministry of Reconciliation, which is a working restorative justice program on Chicago's South Side. Earlier, Father Kelly, you talked about the core principles. There are five pillars: hospitality, accompaniment, relentless engagement of young people, and I'm coming right back to that one, relentless engagement of stakeholders and systems, and collaboration. Typically, when we think of the five pillars of anything or multiple pillars, it is to support the ultimate goal. So they're all very necessary. Which do you view as the first or the most important?
I don't know if I can pick one, but hospitality is an attitude. And hospitality is a willingness to really engage young people, to open the doors, to make sure they feel like they belong. It is a value, if you will, of really saying you're important, and you're so important to us as a community that we want to welcome you here. And so that it's that attitude, and it's the first principle probably in which we meet someone. So if someone comes to the door, if you're not hospitable, if you don't make that person feel safe or welcome, then all the other principles are for naught. They're not going to get to that point. But if you make a young person feel like they belong, then you're going to get to the accompanying part. You're going to get to the relentless engagement part.
Because they're getting the not belonging feeling from the courts and from other places where you guys are trying to help them work through that system.
The biggest issue that we deal with is these are young people who are victims of trauma. So they've had abandonment issues, neglect issues, physical harm issues, sexual abuse issues. So these are harmed young people and their families. And too many people label them. So you have an African-American teenager with other teenagers, and all of a sudden they're a problem, rather than they're a group of teenagers gathered together. So and institutions, schools, churches included, whomever, oftentimes are afraid of these young people. And so they set all kinds of barriers so that they're not going to be a part of the boys' club. They're not going to be part of the church. They're not going to feel connected to the school. And so what we try to do is really work really hard to make sure they know that they belong, that we want them, and not just tolerate. Tolerate means, you know, reluctantly I'll let you in.
Yeah, you can stay here if you need to.
Right. Right. Hospitality is, we were waiting at the door all day for you, and we are so happy you're here. And really communicating that attitude to young people and creating that safety to where they will be truthful with you. They'll say, I need your help, if it's a safe environment.
Now is the time where I want to get back to the relentless engagement, because what triggered in my mind when you said that was the fact that it's so unconditional, and it seems to be like, if you don't want us now, we'll still be there. We're going to be there at 3 a.m. We're going to be there in 3 months. Whenever you're ready, we will still be here. But boy, that's a lot of effort for a payoff that might never come.
It isn't a lot of effort, but it's more of an attitude. It's a more of, you know, I ride a bike and run in the neighborhood, and I'm walking in the neighborhood, and I know what's going on certain blocks. I know why there's 15 kids sitting out or standing out in front of a local store. But I'm still going to call them out by name. I'm going to say, hey, what's up to whomever? Mm-hmm. And to let them know that we value them. We did a circle on December 8th. We did these healing circles. And we did it inside the corner store. And we welcomed people in. And it was amazing when we created that safe environment, how people really spoke their truth and how much they wanted to be a part of a community, but they never felt like they were invited to be a part of that community. And so that's what we strive to do. That's the relentless engagement of saying, I know you're doing some things that you ought not to be doing, but you're still part of our community. You're still part of us.
We still care.
We still care.
Tell me more about the healing circle, because this is not something that I'm super familiar with.
So a peacemaking circle or healing circle is a practice of restorative justice. So restorative justice is to repairing the harm done and being held accountable to repair that harm. Restorative justice in a simplistic kind of way is how you would want it if it was your child. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't want them labeled or demonized as someone evil, but you want them held accountable. You want them to grow and understand what they did was wrong, and they have a responsibility to repair that harm. So one of the practices of restorative justice, that philosophy, that way of thinking, is called the peacemaking circle. And it's a methodology. It's a way of gathering together. It's based on storytelling and common values, and you spend a lot of time with relationships with one another. And then after you have a relationship with those in the circle, then you deal with whatever the issue might be. It could be healing. It could be a sentencing circle, in which this young person has to be sentenced, and instead of the courts doing it, the community does it. But you don't get to the issue until you build relationships with one another, so until you understand who we are in this circle. And so often, when we tend to the relationships, then the issue becomes so less important. And you can get to the issue so much easier, the resolve the issue so much easier, more easily.
Because they feel a comfort and the ability to be vulnerable?
That plus the person who has been victimized, the victim, sees that person differently. So, a circle I had not that long ago in which a kid burglarized a home, the victim of the house in which the burglary happened, he says, man, you're not who I thought you were. You know, I thought you were this little thief and thug, but really, you're a victim also, as we told stories about one another, where we came from. And so it reframes that kind of relationship, where instead of an adversarial relationship, me against you, you begin to recognize in our stories and as we tell stories of one another, wait a minute, you're like I am. Your values are very similar to mine. You have a grandmother who adores you just like I do. And all of a sudden, we're not so far apart. And all of a sudden, there's a possibility of repairing that harm done. And that relationship then is restored. See, crime is a violation of relationships more than a code of conduct. And so we really have to establish places in which we can really build that relationship and repair the relationship that was harmed because of crime or conflict.
Some of the programs I'm seeing, and I'd love to hear a little bit more, restorative justice circles, we've been talking about those, mm-hmm. peace circles, jail ministry, and after-school programs. So tell me a little bit more about the jail ministry.
The jail ministry is simply going to the juvenile detention center or Cook County Jail and visiting. It's kind of a presence. It's a ministry of a presence. So I show up. I go up in the living pods of the juvenile detention center. I visit with young people and just say, how you doing? How are you? That your community, and I'm a priest, so your faith community cares about you, that you are valuable. Because so often kids who are locked up and adults who are locked up, they're isolated. They don't feel like anybody's thinking of them. So anytime we can come in and say, no, you're important to us and we're thinking about you, that's the essence of the ministry I do within the jails. So it's really building a relationship. It's mentoring accompaniment in the jail.
And some of these kids, maybe many of these kids, are going to come back into the community. And that's going to continue that outreach from
all of the kids are coming.
The relentless engagement.
Yeah, all of the kids are going to come back in a community.
Right.
Now, my dream, my hope is that we have these restorative hubs, the precious bloods of the world. We have them in every community in which our young people come from. So if a kid I meet in juvenile detention center is from North Lawndale, I'll be able to say, you know, you've got to meet somebody and he's right in your community. You've got to go to the Lawndale Christian Legal Clinic because they will welcome you just as I welcome you. And if we can connect our young people to those kinds of resources and that relationship in their own community, then the likelihood of them coming back is lessened so often.
Because then if they're in with a core group that's positive and they feel engaged with, mm-hmm. they're less likely to fall back into
into
the other life.
Exactly, because they feel like they're part of the community. And when you feel like you're a part of your community, then you become a co-creator. You don't do things to destroy your community if you're a part of that community.
Mm-hmm.
Like going into your house and messing your own house up, knowing you're going to have to clean it. But so it's your community. But so often our young people don't feel like they belong. And so the role and the goal of a restorative justice hub or Precious Blood or whomever is to help them connect to their community and feel like, you know what, I belong here. Therefore, I'm going to work hard to make my community the best community it can be.
So to engage the disengaged.
Exactly.
After-school programs, if you'd expound on those.
So we build relationships with young people. I often say we're relational first and programmatic second. So the first thing I'm going to do with the young person is get to know that young person. What do you want? What are you working on? What do you need to do? You know, what's your goal? And then once we know and have a relationship with one another, then I'm going to build programming around him. And I deal most with young men. And so I'm going to have after-school programming that reflects the needs of that young person. So we do digital media lab. So we have a lab with all these computers and mics and keyboards of which I know nothing about, and I want to keep it that way. But these kids are engaged with this kind of beats and music and raps and whatnot. It, number one, allows them to express themselves, and so there's a lot of healing in that. If you hear what I'm truly feeling, and I have an ability to express that to you, that's incredibly healing. But it also reflects, because I never would have got into this if it wasn't for young people saying, man, I like to do these raps. And so we try to engage them in that and then build programming around that. And so we do a lot of art for the similar reasons. I'm the last person on the earth, sorry, I'm downtown, but they're going to go to the art museum. But the arts are so incredibly important because these young people can express themselves and talk about the pain and hurt via visual arts or doing murals or doing music or doing poetry or doing theater, whatever the case might be.
Yeah, if we look at the classics, the masters, Picasso had his Blue Period, and you know all of the people that we do go see in the art museums,
right.
Those who see them, those who go, Father Kelly,
yes.
We can tell what they were going through to some degree.
Exactly.
Their emotional state based on their expression of art and music, et cetera.
This is what we learned, too, from Adler and others that help us understand, you know, being trauma-informed, really understanding what trauma does to a young person. And what we understand is that trauma is not always embedded in a part of our brain in which we can verbally talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So we have nightmares and daymares and whatnot that are kind of expressions of this the pain and hurt we have. So if we can help them express themselves and talk about that trauma via art or theater or something like that, then that's what we're really, that's one of the goals of healing.
As I mentioned before, Father Dave Kelly, Executive Director of Precious Blood Ministry of Reconciliation, a working restorative justice program on Chicago's South Side. Thank you so much for your time. I wanted to mention also that you can find our podcast, which is, of course, called On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University at iTunes. And please subscribe. And if there's something here that has spoken to you, touched you, you find valuable, please feel free to share on your social media networks as well. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you again, Father Kelly. This concludes our show. Please join us next week when we discuss the isolated and traumatized lives of police officers. This is Hannah Stanley on Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University.